Good morning. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Hannah Colton, a public health reporter here. We've posted resources, including a domestic violence crisis hotline number, on the webpage for today's show at KUNM.org. Thanks for joining us this morning. This month in Albuquerque, 12 people died after being shot, stabbed, beaten, or abused. At least 12. Dozens of friends, relatives, coworkers, and classmates are now going on with their lives after these killings. If you've ever lost someone to violence, how did you deal with that in the days, months, and years after? We want to hear from you this morning. Call 277-5866 or tell us on Twitter with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM, or you can email letstalk@kunm.org. Our goal with today's show is to remember the many people killed by violence this month and to talk about working through grief and trauma. It will be mainly a place to process grief this morning, but as a heads up, especially if you're listening with young kids, there will be some description of violence that has happened here in Albuquerque this morning. I want to welcome in the studio Pat Carrasco, Executive Director of the New Mexico Resource Center for Victims of Violent Death. Good morning, Pat.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So, Pat, your organization offers all kinds of support to family members of people who've been killed, and we'll get more into those services throughout the hour. But how is losing someone to violence different than losing someone to, say, an illness or old age?
I'm going to start out by changing the word losing. Someone was taken. Mm. That difference makes all the difference to where they are. Usually the loss is something that goes away gradually, but when your loved one is taken, you have that added component of anger, sometimes fear, because if they took your loved one, are they going to take you? Mm. And they immediately become part of the criminal justice system, and they have to relive this every couple of months for years until you may get a trial and you may get justice or not. And it's only after that criminal justice process that they begin to say, okay, now I have to deal with my grief. Before that, they're dealing with process. So that it's so prolonged and it is totally unexpected and no one's ready to deal with that.
So eventually finding closure is a lot harder. The process is so much, yeah.
Can I correct you on another
please,
word?
Please correct me.
We never say closure.
Okay.
There is not ever closure when you lose someone you love. Mm. In fact, that is something that people can help the person by knowing that you can say, gee, it would have been Johnny's birthday or your anniversary, because people think they want to close the door. They don't want to close the door. Mm. They just want to remember with less pain. So we call it resolution or moving forward, but without that person. So closure is like one of those bad words in our work. And I don't mean to be negative to you. I want people to know that it's okay to ask about that loved one, because they keep losing them every other day because no one will say their name again.
Mm.
And people say, how many children do you have? Well, our families don't know what to say. Well, do I include the one that was taken? Yes, that's your child. Or it would have been your wedding anniversary. So it's hard for the people on the other side as it is hard for the families.
Thank you so much for that, Pat. And I think it's so true that we don't talk about death. We don't talk about murder or people being killed very often. It's hard to talk about. And that's such a good reminder that survivors are moving forward with their whole lives. And so that's a good reminder that closure is not really the thing that we're going for. I want to welcome also in the studio this morning, Kelly Geib-Eckenroth with the Children's Grief Center. Hi, Kelly.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thanks for being here. So you deal with a very special subset of grieving people as well. So talk about how grief is different for children.
So children grieve just like other people grieve. Children's grief looks very different, but children grieve. If you're old enough to love, you're old enough to grieve. Children grieve according to a developmental stage they're at. It looks very different. Grief looks very different for everyone in the family. There are some things that are common among children, though. Children, we think of grief, we think of sadness usually. Children's grief could be anxiety, worrying about somebody else dying. With elementary age kids, there's a lot of anger.
And so your organization, the Children's Grief Center, primarily runs support groups, right?
Yes.
What do those look like?
Yeah, we provide peer support groups for children and their families. So children are placed in a group of their peers. We divide kids depending on age or developmental stage as appropriate. And we use a variety of grief-related projects, crafts, games, activities, and just being together. This helps children to make their way through the grief process. We are not clinicians, so our groups are run by volunteers. And just, you know, just being with people who get it makes kids feel like it's normal. It normalizes the grief process, and it gives them a space to cope. Oftentimes, kids might hide their true feelings with the other family members because they don't want them to be sad. But in a group, they can express whatever they're going through.
So it sort of allows space to express things that they may be trying to protect their other family members from, in a way.
Yes, yes. I remember one time we had a call, and the mom told us that the younger child had told her that he goes into the bathroom to cry because he doesn't want to make her feel sad. But at the Grief Center, all feelings are welcome. We even have a room called the Steam Room where kids can go in. It's not a steam room. It's a room where kids can go to let off steam. It's padded, and there's lots of things that they can punch and just snuggle and get out all those big feelings.
Can I add one thing? It's also a place where they can be happy.
Absolutely. There's a lot of laughter at the Grief Center.
People don't think you're allowed to be happy again. And when we tell them that it is okay to be happy, say, oh, thank you. The grief doesn't go away. As Kelly, grief is the price of love. And your loved one wouldn't want you to go through your whole life sad and miserable and unhappy. So the Children's Grief Center is so wonderful because it allows our family, our adult families, to also heal because their children are being cared for. And that takes a big burden off of them. And Kelly, they have a program that touches my heart. When a wife is taken, a wife and mother is taken, that leaves a father alone with kids. They have no idea what they do, and they have a program for dads who are new caregivers. You tell it better than I can.
Yeah, we have a men's support group. I can hear myself now. We have a men's support group, so I noticed several years ago that the men were coming to support groups bringing their children, and they were in a group with lots of women, and then they all of a sudden stopped showing up. And it was really hard for men to kind of share their true feelings with the group of women. They kind of let the women take over. So we started a men's group, and it's really grown. The men have really come to support each other and express true feelings. And the first time I noticed there were tissues in the trash can in that group room, I was just so touched to know that men could cry together and support each other in such a loving way. And Pat's right, we have support groups for all family members. So if someone, if a parent is bringing five kids, we try to divide those children up so they each have their own support group. So we divide kids by age or developmental stage so they each have their own safe space to share their feelings.
That's so good to know that there's a place in our community for that individualized but group-centered support. We are talking today on Let's Talk New Mexico about people who've been taken, people who've been killed in our communities recently, especially. If you've lost a relative or friend, how do you remember and honor them? Do you have thoughts or advice for people going through this right now? If you've seen violence around you in your community or abuse, how are you dealing with that? Give us a call this morning, 277-5866. And I do want to note, as we discuss shootings and other violence this morning, there may be a lot of things that come up for you as a listener. There's, you know, the motives or mental state of perpetrators. There's gun control. There's flaws in the criminal justice system. Some victims of violence may have done bad things themselves during their lifetime. And those are all totally valid things to be thinking about and concerned about. But that is not what today's show is for. So just a note here at the top of the show, we're going to stick to memorial and processing grief. Again, we have Kelly Geib-Eckenroth with the Children's Grief Center this morning, Pat Caristo with the Resource Center for Victims of Violent Death. And I wanted to follow up. We've talked a little bit already about words to use and not use, and it's hard to even remember. But are there better or worse ways to talk to kids about grief?
I'm glad you asked that question. I wanted to talk about that. It's really important that kids know the truth, that kids are told what happened in a simple way. Kids will ask for information that they want to know, but it's important to be honest and open with your children. It helps minimize the confusion and the misinformation. And eventually, kids will find out information. And if you are telling them, you can control the information that they know. Also, if children aren't given the truth, they don't trust the adults in their lives if they're not being honest with them. And kids will ask for what the information they want to know. And it's important to know that they may ask it over and over again, because kids take in small bits of information at a time and they're processing what they've learned.
And as you mentioned just now, Kelly, the expectations around emotional processing in our culture are very gendered. So we think,
yes,
we think that women cry. We think that men shouldn't or don't cry. Violent crime is also very gendered, right? So most of perpetrators are men. The majority of care providers are often women.
Yeah.
So what kinds of unique support do you try to offer for boys and men in particular?
Well, boys are very physical in their grief. So we give them lots of expressions for expressing their anger. We do a lot of games outside. We throw water balloons. We write down things that we're frustrated about and throw water balloons at the wall. I'm trying to think of some other things we do, just scribbling, knocking things over, tossing pillows, things that helps get out some of that anger.
And that's those are really good, concrete things that a parent could do at home with their child, too, right? Say,
absolutely,
this is scribbling time, or this is time for we're just going to throw water balloons as hard as we can.
Right. Because it's important for kids to know that it's OK to let out those big feelings, but that they can't hurt anybody, that it's OK to be angry, but you can't kick me. You can't throw your toys. There are productive ways to get that anger out.
And Pat, that's something that I wanted to ask you about is there's so much anger in the wake of these deaths. And how do you talk to people about making sure that those feelings of anger don't turn into, motivations of revenge or I need to go out and hurt this person?
That's a big problem. Most of the time, that's a big problem for the dad in the family. He did not protect his child, his wife, whatever. And they have no avenue to get rid of those feelings. So we recommend the gym, get a punching bag, get rid of that, because that is in all of us. Housekeepers, homemakers have that ability. Your house is never cleaner than when you're angry in your rage. The dad doesn't have a way to do that. And The other issue for families is guilt. If the last words you said to that child or that loved one before they left the house was a negative one, you feel guilty. And if I hadn't said that, maybe they wouldn't have gone out. The person who's responsible is the person who did it. We spend a lot of time taking away or trying to take away the grief within the family. And sometimes these things destroy families because you're not grieving the way I think you should grieve. That means you didn't love them as much as I did. And then they're fighting among themselves. That person that took that person takes away the whole family sometimes from each other. So part of the group process is being allowed to say those things and then talk with other family members who've been through the same thing. And also to recognize that all of that range of feeling is normal. Many of our family members think they're going crazy. And we tell them it is okay to feel what you're feeling. You're normal in an abnormal situation. And sometimes they'll just say, thank you. I just thought I was losing it.
Normal in an abnormal situation. That's such a good thing to keep in mind. This morning, we're talking about how people deal with grief after a loved one is killed. What is it like to hear about these tragedies? What support do you need? And if you've lost someone in your family or community, if someone has been taken from you, what is difficult about getting help? How hard is it to talk about this pain? You can call in this morning, 277-5866. After a quick break, we'll have a special segment to remember about 15 individuals killed in Albuquerque in April. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. We'll be back in a minute.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Representing Native American tribes, people facing criminal charges, civil rights plaintiffs, and victims of sexual abuse. Info at rothsteinlaw.com.
Support comes from Popejoy Hall, where author and humorist David Sedaris returns to Popejoy for one performance to read from his latest book, Calypso, on Sunday, May 5th. Tickets and more information at popejoypresents.com.
Next time on Peace Talks Radio, the man in black, Johnny Cash, in a moment of inner conflict in his career and personal point of view, bumps up against Richard Nixon in a Netflix film.
Nixon thought he could understand Johnny Cash because the two men had somewhat similar upbringings. So Nixon's team asked Johnny Cash to sing Okie from Muskogee and Welfare Cadillac.
Neither one of which Johnny Cash wrote.
Exactly.
Sarah Dosa, director of Tricky Dick and the Man in Black, next time on Peace Talks Radio, Friday morning at 8 on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. Thank you for tuning in this morning. I'm your host, Hannah Colton, a public health reporter here. Today, we're remembering people killed by violence and talking about ways to cope with grief and trauma, both individually and within families and within communities. If you've lost someone, how does grief change over time? Who or what has been most helpful to you in that process? Give us a call, 277-5866, or if you're outside the Albuquerque area, call 1-877-899-5866. In the studio this morning, we've heard from Pat Caristo with the Resource Center for Victims of Violent Death, Kelly Guybe Eckenroth with the Children's Grief Center, and we'll hear more from more people later this hour. But now we'll take some time to remember each victim of violence in Albuquerque from this month. For those who I could find obituaries or crowdfunding pages for services, I'll share a little bit about them. This is a time of memorial. Kalia Johnson, 11 months old. Sarah Dubois Guilbeault, 5 years old. On a GoFundMe page, her mother wrote Sarah had a very positive and playful spirit and that she would love to act out movie scenes. She said Sarah had been diagnosed with autism. Diamond Williams, 8 months old. 8 years old, excuse me. Martin Maestas, 15 years old. Eric Vincent Apisa, 19 years old, of Las Vegas, Nevada. Jose Federico, 21 years old, of Santa Rosa, New Mexico. His obituary says Jose was an avid skateboarder who took the time to teach his cousins to skateboard. He also liked to make friendship bracelets and watch football games. He was a parishioner of St. Rose of Lima Catholic Church. Cody Raver, 33 years old. A GoFundMe page set up by a friend says Cody is much loved by the skate community. He would give you the shirt off his back and the skin off his hands. Erica Marie Nilsson, 38 years old. Erica's obituary says she was a mother of three. She's known for her sweet personality, big smile, beautiful laughter, and sweet soul. She enjoyed listening to a wide variety of music. Erica studied sociology and criminology at UNM. Jason Brown, 38 years old. Eric Trujillo, 39 years old. Anthony Cortez, 39 years old. Salvador Gallegos, 40 years old. Cecily Corazon, 43 years old. Jose Nieve Pepe Hernandez, 47 years old, of Phoenix, Arizona. His obituary says Pepe served in the Army, worked as a civil engineer, and then worked for 11 years for the U.S. Postal Service in Albuquerque. He had recently started a side business as a DJ. Jose was a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Those were the names of people who were killed in Albuquerque this month, a particularly tragic month for communities here. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. Thank you for tuning in this morning. If you've had someone taken by violence recently or years ago, how does that grief change as your life moves on? What is helpful to you? What kinds of support do you need? What's the least helpful thing you've been told after someone has died? Give us a call this morning. We'd like to hear from you. 277-5866. You can tweet us with hashtag #LetsTalkNM or email letstalk@kunm.org. I want to welcome in the studio this morning Marta Pereira, Associate Director of Programs at Enlace Comunitario.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for being here, Marta. So you work primarily with domestic violence prevention and intervention. Why is it important to talk about domestic violence when we're thinking about these murders and these people lost?
It is crucial. It is very crucial for us to talk about domestic violence, because as we see so many violent crimes that we're also throughout our city that are dealing with domestic violence as well, these conversations are not often spoken about it due to many issues. So I think it's very important for us to have these conversations and make sure that we create a safe space for individuals that are going through domestic violence and make sure that they find support before it gets to where we are right now and losing family members and families due to domestic violence. So I think it's very important and it's crucial for us to have those conversations in order for us to find that support.
So when someone, mostly women, I imagine, come into your office, what kinds of things do they generally need? I mean, what kinds of resources are you immediately offering?
So, my apologies. So when they come through Enlace Comunitario, survivors of domestic violence come in crisis. They're needing basic resources from shelter, food, safety planning, orders of protections, counseling services, support groups like we've been hearing from our attendees here. They're needing a lot of support. We serve survivors and their children with individual counseling. Like I said, providing a safe space in order for them to either flee from the abuse, if that's what they're choosing to do, or just provide the support while they remain in a relationship that's abusive. So safety planning is huge, not only for them and their children, but it's very important for us to have those conversations and ensure that we provide resources as safety planning and all.
Marta, what do people often misunderstand or, say, wrongly assume about people who are experiencing situations of domestic violence? Like, what are some really harmful, like, stereotypes?
Well, a lot of things you may hear. Why don't they just leave the situation? That's something that you hear often. So it's important for us to know that it's not that easy. There's so many barriers and so many things that come into place. There is fear. There is believing that abuse is normal. They may have grown up in a household where they witness it and they think it's normal. There is the embarrassment of shame, cultural issues, religious issues. There's financial issues. Oftentimes, the aggressors, if not 99% of the time, they're the sole breadwinners. So you have families and children that have no source of income, nowhere to go. They have been isolated from family members. A lot of times, they're not from here. They're from other countries. So they have nobody to turn to and no resources that they are aware of in order to seek that assistance. So there's many assumptions that is easy. Why, if this were to happen to me, I would just leave. Unfortunately, that's not the case. There's so many things that come into place as to why a victim, survivor of domestic violence does not leave the situation.
And we know also that that women who are Hispanic, women who are Native American, experience domestic violence at higher rates. And so there are things, like you said, many barriers that people who haven't experienced it just wouldn't understand. So you and your staff deal with these issues all the time. We're talking today about how to deal with grief and how to deal when you've witnessed trauma. How do you and your staff take care of yourselves when you're working with these issues all the time?
That's something that, you know, we all find our own ways. I think self-care is very important when you're the secondary trauma that comes with serving survivors of domestic violence and just overall trauma. A lot of times we have some staff that go on walks during lunch. There is yoga classes. As an agency, it's very important for our staff to be okay and for them to find that space to talk to one another in order to process a situation right after they have heard the survivor talk about it. So as well as we provide a wellness benefit where they can take a yoga class if they choose to. So we all find different ways, reading, a lot of times just spending time with our families. So there's so many ways as that our staff take care of themselves, and then just recognizing that they need that. That's very important for them to take.
We are talking about grief this morning, about processing trauma, individually and together in communities. You can give us a call, 277-5866. With us on the line this morning is Elena Salazar, whose 15-year-old son was shot and killed earlier this month. Elena, thank you so much for being on the show during a really difficult time.
Thank you.
Good morning. Do you want to tell us a bit about your son, Martin? I mean, how would he want to be remembered?
Well, he was remembered for his green, beautiful eyes, his big smile, and he never wanted anybody to be alone, whether it was his friends or his family. He would always be there with somebody. He would always just tell them, don't go alone. Like, I would want to go to the store by myself, and he's like, I'm going with your mom or his brothers, his friends. I mean, he was always he never wanted anybody to be alone by themselves. And he was just always, he was caring, you know, always willing to help. And I miss him. I miss his smile, his eyes, his touch.
He sounds so sweet. When you think about remembering and honoring Martin in the weeks and years to come, what's important for you to think about? What kinds of support do you appreciate getting from your family, friends?
I appreciate, when this happened, I was so numb. I was lost. I didn't know what to do. And I thank God that I have a big support group. My brother, Paul Castillo, my parents, my brother's wife, his kids. Everybody just jumped in and helped me and surrounded me, and I still have them and I feel like I can lean on them, but I still feel like I'm empty inside, and I know I need to trust in God, and I think that's what's getting me through every day as well, is just prayer and believing that, I have Martin by my side and also God.
And Elena, you have three younger sons, and you're a single parent. What has this been like for you? How are you managing the day-to-day?
It's hard. There's days that we wake up and I don't want to do nothing, but my kids get me up and they're like, let's go. We got to go do this or we got to go do that. There's days that my other son, he's 13, he just goes and stays in their room, his and Martin's room, and we try to get him out as much as we can. My oldest son, he's in football and wrestling, so I think he's doing it through that way with football. And my little one is still I think he knows his brother's gone, but he's just real always happy, and he's not showing no sign of grief or. But I believe he's hurting because there's times at night we'll be laying there and he just tells me, I miss Martin, Mama. And so we just start to pray for him.
I want to put this to one of our other guests, Kelly Geib-Eckenroth from the Children's Grief Center. All those things that Elena is describing sound totally normal to you, right?
They sound really normal to me. Teenagers often kind of withdraw. I'm guessing your younger child might be under 8, somewhere in there.
He just turned 9 in January.
Nine, yeah. Children at that age are just beginning to understand that death is final, and that the person's not coming back. And they do kind of dose themselves with grief. They can move in and out because it's too painful to take all this in all at once. It's almost like children are given this mechanism in life that they can only take grief a little bit at a time to kind of help them process it. And I think the kids are really wise. Routine and structure is really good. It's hard when everything seems so out of control. Having some routine really, really helps to kind of just keep things rolling along.
Thanks, Kelly.
Yeah.
And we will have to go to a break here in just a couple minutes. But Elena, before we let you go, what are your hopes for your boys as you process this with them? What kinds of things do you hope that they are able to find as far as resources in school?
Well, I know with a lot of the counselors, when we talked to them, and my kids just barely went to school this week, and the counselors have been so great. They've been giving us resources and. If they need anything if we need anything, they just have given us their numbers and places we can call. But I know that me and my kids, we are going to go get some counseling and stuff because, at the end of the day, it was just me and my four boys. And it's somebody just took a big piece of my heart out, and I believe with their brothers as well. And we need some kind of counseling. And I mean, I know my friends and families are here, but I think it would be good for us to just talk to somebody else as well.
Absolutely. And Elena, thank you so much for sharing today. I know this is not easy at all. And is there anything you want to share just about Martin before we let you go?
That he was loving. He loved everybody. And I mean, I don't believe that he would hurt anybody. And he was there for everybody. He loved his family. He loved his brothers, his Nana and Tata, his uncles. And I know he loved me too.
Thank you so much, Elena Salazar. We do have resources posted at KUNM.org. If this conversation is bringing up difficult feelings for you, there's a hotline for anyone experiencing emotional crisis, and there's also a domestic violence hotline number. If this is something you've gone through, if you're hearing anything that is resonating today, you can call in and share what helped you through these really hard times. We're at 277-5866. You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM 89.9. Let's go to a quick break.
As capitalism develops, there are cleavages and splits in the working class, and sometimes, of course, employers like these splits. Certainly, divisions, and especially by race and by gender and by part of the world, are really critical cleavages within the working class.
This edition of AR features Michael Yates on the working class.
That's Alternative Radio, Saturday night at 6 on KUNM.
Skip the hassle of finding a buyer for that unwanted car. Donate it to KUNM and turn it into great radio. Or maybe you've got a truck, boat, or an RV you don't want anymore. Donate it to KUNM. It's very easy. It qualifies you for KUNM membership, and it helps KUNM a lot. Call today, 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM 89.9. I'm Hannah Colton. This morning, we're talking about how to find support after someone in your family, perhaps in your community, has been taken by violence. What is it like hearing about violent deaths on the news and on social media? Are there different kinds of coverage or different kinds of dialogue that you'd like to see? Give us a call, 277-5866. We did have a comment from a caller who said her son died of an overdose after becoming addicted to pain medication. It's been over 2 years, and she'd like to see justice for him, which would be that the people who made it possible for him to become addicted to be held accountable and for them to have to pay for rehab services so that other people can get safe addiction care and not bounce in and out of jail. This caller said that's what would help her process her grief. In the studio this morning, Pat Caristo from the Resource Center for Victims of Violent Death. Is that something that you see people saying, look, the you know, reparation that I really want is more services?
And may I say that that's considered a violent death that we help with. So if our agency can be a resource for them, please have her give us a call. And I wanted to say to Elena, if she's still listening, that she did a good job, that she's doing a good job. And everything she said means she's going to be okay. She just needs to get through this. And for the caller about the loss because of substance abuse, that is still a taking. It wasn't a choice. It was a taking. And we can help. And we also help those families where there's been an attempted murder, because there's no place for those families to go. They are not dead because the person didn't try. And they're dealing with all of that fear and aftermath and what if, and we can help them too. There are more resources than people realize but not enough resources for everything.
And what's the number? Will you say the number for your center?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
505-243-2222.
And sometimes, you know, people might think they just really need to be alone when they're sad. Why is it helpful for people to process together in either in family and support group or in community, say in a church setting or a group?
The value of group is that it is a place where you can do exactly what you asked Elena to tell us about your loved one, because the community can't ask that question because they don't know if they're going to hurt your feelings or make you cry, and there's nothing wrong with crying. But in group, you can say, this is what I loved, or this is what was funny about, or this is what he did that made me or she made me go berserk. But it is also a place where you can see your progress. When you come in the first couple of weeks, sometimes you can't say anything at all. But then after a few groups, you're ending up helping a new family that comes in, and you can say, wow, I see I am making progress. So group, you can say the same thing every time you come, and people won't tell you, well, you already said that. They need to say it again and again and again, and we'll listen. And mostly, we try not to talk too much to allow them to say what they say.
And we did have an email question from a different listener. She said one of her friends was a witness of one of the recent shootings and is really struggling. So what kinds of support are available for witnesses of violence?
Several of our clients are witnesses. We can provide the same support that we provide to everyone else. So, yes, witnesses suffer because of what they saw. And again, call us. We can refer you. We can help you. You can join in with our group. And they are an unknown victim section.
There's also the Albuquerque Area Trauma Recovery Network, and they actually help people who witness violence or were part of violence who have trauma in the first 3 months after the incident.
Why are those first 3 months particularly important? This is not your resource center.
This is not my wheelhouse. So
No worries.
I just think the trauma is so prevalent and so real right at the beginning there. I think that just catching it, you know, and getting support right away has got to be helpful.
Absolutely. So. And we will have a list of all these resources on our website, KUNM.org, on the show page for today's show. The Resource Center for Victims of Violent Death, I wanted to shout out just the URL right now. It's bridgesforvictimsofviolentdeath.org. That's Pat's organization. And Marta Pereira of Enlace Comunitario, we've been talking about these sort of invisible survivors, right? And you also work with children who've witnessed a lot of violence and abuse. So what's important when you're working with those kid witnesses?
It's very important for us. So as I mentioned earlier, we do provide individual counseling as well as support groups and family counseling for the parent and child. And I think it's very important for us to understand that they're dealing with the same trauma. Oftentimes you hear, oh, they didn't see this, they didn't hear this, but they do, they hear. So it's very important for us to validate those feelings, support them where they're at. Find out each child is unique and very different, and we all process the information differently. So it's very important for us to meet with the child, do the safety planning, what is going on in his unique situation, and we can find ways to support them, either through counseling. The support groups are huge. You see a lot of laughter with children that are going through the same things, and they support one another. So I think it's very important for us to understand that there's so much trauma that goes on within the household when there's domestic violence that is going on. So just meeting them where they're at, seeing what the need of that specific child is. And see, each child, like I said, needs different support. So that's where we're able to identify what that need for the child may be. And safety plannings are always done with children.
What does that mean? What do you mean safety planning when we're talking about domestic violence? And particularly in Lasse works with intimate partner violence,
yes,
right?
Yes. So safety planning with children will look like talking to them, asking them if there is something that were to happen. I just say if they have separated from their other parent, the abusive partner in this specific case, when not to open the door. Who can they call? Are there safe places within this household? Can they go to a neighbor? If they're in a school setting, when they see this person, who can they go to? Their teacher or an adult that's there, not to live with that person out of the school. So there's different ways that you can safety plan with children as well as adults. The adult, it looks totally different as well. You know, there's a difference between safety planning with a survivor that's still in the household with a perpetrator versus somebody that has already left and they're already in a safe place. So if they're still there, what can they do in terms of if there's an incident that happened? Who can they call? Do they know the neighbors? Do they have family members contact information memorized? Because a lot of times a perpetrator, the first thing they would do is take the phone away. So if they have to flee from the home, what that would look like? Where would they go? And if they've already separated, changing the locks in their home, and do they have the resources to do that? If they're living in an apartment, they would have to talk to the landlord. And so steps that they can take for different things depending on the situation. And if they have a routine that they had when they were with the abusive partner, would they can change the routes that they take to work. Or if they relocated from one place to another, what would that look like if they see this person in a public setting? So there's so many ways. That's what it will look like in terms of having those conversations, because oftentimes a lot of survivors, specifically with the survivor, we serve immigrant survivors of domestic violence. So there's the language barrier that comes into place. If I call the police, what is this going to look like? We see the immigration status as well, where the perpetrator is using the immigration status to continue to perpetrate the abuse. And when they...
By saying, hey, you can't call the cops or they're going to find you.
Yeah, you can't call the police. They will arrest you. You don't have any rights in this country.
And how do you correct that thinking for survivors?
It starts with providing them resources, what their rights are. You have rights here. Whether, you know, a lot of times it's hard and it's just repeating, like we've been talking about it. It's something that you have to constantly repeat. We have to remember that a lot of the survivors have been in the situations for years. And even if they haven't, and it's one of those things that starts with the emotional, psychological abuse. And that can life a lifetime. So it's something that they're going to have to continue to work. So it's more than something that you can repeat, creating a safe space for them to have those conversations and know that they can ask you for resources. Our advocates at Enlace, they go to hearings for orders of protections, for divorces custody, whether pro se or with direct legal representation with our attorneys. We accompany them to criminal hearings where they have been identified as the survivor in the specific cases. So just helping them navigate through this difficult systems that oftentimes, even us, when we're familiar with resources, is also so very hard for us to do. So
absolutely. I want to take a listener call. Ellen is on the line from Albuquerque. Ellen, what would you like to add this morning?
Yeah, good morning, everybody. I just wanted to offer a word of encouragement only because, in a sense, I had a similar experience, but it involved a car accident, a violent car accident. And so I was a baby at the time, but it devastated my parents because it took two of my sisters. And so, but I just wanted to encourage you, all of you that are going through this, that to hang on don't give up and rely on each other and seek out the help that's available. So, you know.
Ellen, thank you so much for sharing that with us. I know that is really hard to talk about. Do you have thoughts for people who may be going through something similar, or what would your advice be?
Basically, just to keep going, seek out the help, because it's out there, and you know, just find resources. I mean, I love punching bags, so if you have to take out your aggression, find a punching bag and just punch the heck out of it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that call, Ellen. And we should add, right, taking it out in physical ways, not just for boys and men. Right. It's just for everyone, right? Pat, from the Resource Center for Victims of Violent Death, what are some misunderstandings that you run into from folks who maybe don't understand what it's like to have had a family member taken in such a way?
I want to add something based on what the caller said and the barriers in domestic violence of leaving, because there's another word that hasn't been mentioned, and it also implies in violent death and for the children, love. These people still love the people who are hurting them. Mm-hmm. That causes mixed feelings. And in the case of homicides, the statistic used to be you were more likely killed by someone you loved. Now the statistics have changed. Now you're more likely to be killed by a stranger for no reason at all, which adds a whole nother complication. But these children and the wives and the partners love each other even in spite of all of this. Children that are taken out of bad homes, troubled homes, will often run away. And where do they go? Back to the home that they left, because love was there too. that's a misconception that people go around hating each other, and they don't. They love each other. And in cases where the homicide was done by a family member that they also love too, that's a complication. Need to be able to talk about, I both love you and hate you.
Absolutely. Kelly Geib-Eckenroth from the Children's Grief Center. Any final thoughts? We have just about a minute or so left.
Well, I was just thinking about the stigma surrounding murder, that family members often encounter negative judgment and assumptions about the person who died, and that they can't even, you know, honor their loved one the way they remember them, because they're bombarded with this idea that they must have been a bad person. That's why they were murdered. And that's so hurtful.
Right. And so encouraging folks to remember the person as they really were.
Or find out who that person was. They're not somebody who's 2-minute clip on the news. They were a living, breathing person, a mother, a father, a son, a daughter.
Thank you for that. We're out of time for today. Thank you so much to our guests, Elena Salazar, Marta Pereira, Pat Caristo, and Kelly Geib-Eckenroth. And thank you to everyone who called in and shared your thoughts. If any part of this was hard to hear this morning or leaves you feeling rough, we do have resources posted on our website, people you can talk to right now, today, on a hotline or warm line. Go to KUNM.org. You can also comment on our Facebook page to continue this conversation. If you missed any part of the show, you can listen on KUNM.org. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Celia Rainey live tweeted the show. Kaveh Movahed screened your calls. Elaine Baumgartel executive produced. I'm Hannah Colton. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.